Eat Drink Indiana Radio is brought to you by Eskenazi Health, one of Central Indiana's leading providers of health care. Eat Drink Indiana Radio is powered by EatDrinkIndy.com, where Central Indiana turns to learn about food from farm to fork and drink from grains to glass.
Welcome to Eat Drink Indiana Radio and WFYI HD to the Point. I'm your host, Jolene Ketzenberger. We've got some fun stuff for you here on your 4th of July weekend and a cool combination of classic Indiana, perfect for a holiday. We're starting off today talking about vintage recipes, inspired by the new TV program, The Astronaut Wives Club, set in the early 1960s, which sets the scene with plenty of classic dishes, specifically Jell-O salads. So we're talking and tasting Jell-O salads today, and talking with Indianapolis resident and cooking enthusiast Lynn Steinhauer-Habig, as well as Nouveau News Weekly food editor Sarah Merle, and Courtney Yarborough, Assistant Director of Development at the School of Public and Environmental Affairs at IUPUI. And then we will shift gears and head out for lunch at a local restaurant with breaded pork tenderloin expert Rick Garrett, who writes a blog reviewing Indiana tenderloin sandwiches, breadedtenderloin.wordpress.com. So, Jell-O salads and tenderloin sandwiches, it just doesn't get any better than that for your 4th of July weekend. So stay with us here on Eat Drink Indiana Radio on WFYI and WFYI.org. With the new ABC television series, The Astronaut Wives Club, about the wives of the Mercury 7 astronauts in the early 1960s, there's a renewed interest in the food of the era, because the vintage dishes of the 60s are visible all over the show. Cakes, colorful desserts, and yes, jiggly Jell-O molds. In fact, there's a scene in the first episode that shows one of the astronaut wives making something out of mayonnaise and lime Jell-O. Now, I recently read a piece in Bon Appetit about food stylist Emily Marshall, who created all those vintage dishes for the TV show. In fact, you can follow her on Instagram at Jell-O and Casseroles and check out some cool photos. So anyway, I've been thinking lately about those old recipes. And honestly, I've been wondering, how did they taste? Were they really any good? I mean, I like Jell-O well enough. My mom made it for us all the time when I was a kid, but I was a kid of the 70s, and I don't remember my mom putting anything into Jell-O, and certainly not whirring it up in a blender and putting it in a Jell-O mold. So I've been wondering, why would you add a bunch of stuff to Jell-O and call it a salad? And could it possibly, actually, be good? So that's what I wanted to find out this week. Now, I have to admit to a pretty extensive collection of cookbooks. Classics like Julia Child and The Joy of Cooking, big collections from Bon Appetit or Gourmet, authoritative how-tos from Cooks Illustrated, celebrity cookbooks and single-ingredient cookbooks, and books that focus on a specific technique. But I've got a particular shelf dedicated to the community cookbook, or what I tend to call church lady cookbooks, although many of them are from organizations like Tri Kappa or the Junior League. And I especially like the community cookbooks because they seem to truly reflect what people around the country in the 1950s or 60s or 70s were really cooking in a particular time and place. Want to know what people really ate in various parts of the country? Check the church cookbooks and the service club ladies' auxiliary cookbooks and even the recipe pamphlets put out by the local gas company or appliance dealer. In fact, it was in the recipe book that came with her vintage Osterizer blender that one of our guests this week found the instructions for the Jell-O salad that she made for me to try earlier this week. Indianapolis resident Lynn Steinhauer-Habig pulled out a few 70s-era cookbooks, including the Osterizer cookbook with the Salad of Gold recipe, and I stopped by to take a look and to actually try a Jell-O salad. So you just mix it all up?
Well, the Osterizer, it came in the Osterizer cookbook, so you use the Osterizer for everything.
So you still have your Osterizer cookbook?
I still have the cookbook.
Spin Cookery, it says.
Yep, it almost fell out at the... There it is. And the lime cheese, which I think you said someone else is making, That was a popular one. And this, and then the other one, and this even goes back farther than the 70s, but the was one that was cherry Jell-O, Red Hots, cream cheese that had been rolled into little balls with chopped pecans, probably celery. I imagine celery was in there somewhere. But you just, no matter where you went for luncheon or bridge, they were going to pop up. It's beautiful in a very odd way.
Oh, it is odd. You think?
Well, it's odd because we don't do this anymore. Now salads are, you know, hand-torn and have 17 different kinds of lettuces that are good for you and kale and who knows what else.
Oh, my goodness. So we actually get to try a Jell-O salad.
So tell me about the Jell-O salad, though. What's in it?
Well, it doesn't sound very appealing I started to say 1915. This was 2015. It's carrots, cottage cheese, gelatin, the Jell-O brand, gelatin, lemon gelatin, crushed pineapple, pineapple juice, and the creaminess of it is evaporated milk.
Well, okay.
So it's not bad for you.
I'm going to give it a try.
But the proof is in the taste, so have a bite. Oh, it's not so bad.
No, it isn't. How interesting is that?
Ooh.
It's tart.
I believe it has vinegar in it. That's the one. Well, see, 70 years old. I forgot the vinegar.
vinegar in it. So it's light and tart, and it has a smoothish
and
texture.
Fluffy.
Yeah. Fluffy, that's what it is.
Now, I was thinking it was back in the day, it was fun to have, you know, ladies who lunch, that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
And it occurred to me that it might be fun to use these little Pyrex molds. And do individual ones. In fact, you could do
individual
different colors
Jell-O molds,
or, you know, whatever.
Yeah.
And then you could have your mint leaves or whatever, or your butter lettuce already out. It really
right,
looks,
some lettuce.
It doesn't look very pretty, you know, pale yellow and pale white.
No, I don't. I think it's just lovely. I think it's oddly lovely.
Well, it is. It is kind of oddly lovely, but the color is something because it's sort of a, what would you call that? A pale. Pale, pale yellow, with a little blush of peach or something. I mean, it's a kind of a challenging color all by itself. You want to make something a little more festive.
When did they disappear? When did we stop making Jell-O molds and Jell-O salads? Or maybe we still make them.
Well, most of what I've been talking to you about. These molds were centered around ladies who lunched, ladies who played bridge, ladies who were ladies of leisure. And those ladies of leisure went to work.
That's exactly right. So everyone's working now.
I mean, work outside the home. So that kind of fun meal, light meal that would accompany whatever the social event was, kind of began to disappear. And then we got a little more cognizant of health.
True. So in the 70s, when so many women went back to work, so there went your bridge club.
Your book group may have survived. It would be in the evening, but that usually brought out wine. I mean, you don't need a Jell-O mold after 5 o'clock.
That's exactly right.
Just between you and me and the mud fence.
It's tasty.
It is tasty. Well, I have to tell you, when I made it up, and my daughter was teasing me about having made this mold that she hasn't had since she was probably in the 4th grade, she said, you know, if there's any left over, we'd probably like it for dinner. She being the working woman. So I'll probably take it up there.
Well, I think it, you know, because it's interesting and different, and it, you know, it's kind of refreshing, actually.
Well, it is. Anything cold, right. You know, is refreshing and light.
Honestly, I know it has carrots in there, but it doesn't seem like a salad.
Oh, no. No, it's much more like a dessert. And with a kind of a Jell-O salad like this, the hostess, and this was very popular back in that day, would have had some sort of a stacked sandwich. There would have been Boston brown bread and maybe chicken salad and then another piece of maybe a whole wheat bread, then maybe an egg salad or a Philadelphia cream cheese pineapple mix. Then another piece of bread, then a pineapple, then another piece of bread, and then it would be iced with cream cheese that had been softened with, you know, some sort of a milk product. So that would have been the main dish, and then you'd have had, I mean, that's a lot of calories by the time.
That's a lot of calories.
There's a lot of calories. And bridge is an invigorating game, but it doesn't use much in the way of calories. But that's just the way we lived in those days. And it's kind of fun to have been thinking about the olden days.
We've been talking with Lynn Steinhauer-Habig and sampling a classic Jell-O salad. Stay with us for more here on WFYI and WFYI.org. Well, we are back here on Eat, Drink, Indiana Radio talking vintage recipes today with Lynn Steinhauer-Habig. We've been talking about and sampling a classic Jell-O salad and wondering how and when and why tastes changed. You say the olden days. It's not like a million years ago. We're probably talking the 70s?
But we've blinked since then. You know, we have really, as women, and in my family at least, women were the primary meal makers and meal planners and so forth. We just think so differently about food. My sister and I talk about this a lot. You know, this is not something, when she made green beans for dinner, they may have been cooking for 45 minutes. You know, we would never do that. Now, in fact, ours are practically raw when we, you know, our whole mindset is different about how we approach food, what food means. Look how hard it is to have your whole family together at table.
Oh, exactly, to have a dinner where everyone's there and that everyone's going to eat the same thing, you
sure.
know, because, you know,
because
some people don't eat
this. This person is a vegetarian,
right.
This person is a vegan, right. vegan, this, you know, whatever.
Right.
Our family's full of, you know, interesting food
communities.
So we have, you know, somebody doesn't right. want this, somebody doesn't want that. So you end up sort of catch as catch can.
Mm-hmm. And you are sports.
Oh, my gosh, and our schedules, right?
Theater things, art, you know, all the myriad of activities that not only our kids are in, but we're in.
Well, absolutely. Now, you know, back in the day, did you typically, you were a sort of a back-to-nature kind of person. You were doing all the bread-making and cooking
yeah.
and everything, right?
Well, I still do just because I love it, you know. And if it's your passion, it doesn't matter
that's
how
right.
much
that's right.
it is. You do
right.
anything to do it. But it's always been important. And we had breakfast, lunch, and dinner as a family, period.
And you were cooking that.
And I was cooking it, sure. I was
oh
growing
my gosh.
Most of it.
Oh, my goodness.
But that's just what I like to do. I'm not saying, you know, I was not the pioneer woman, but... I would have liked to have been, but I would like all my modern amenities.
I was thinking more along the lines of Earth Mother, you know, that
yeah,
sort of
Earth
thing.
Mother. Well, I was a hippie.
See, I knew it.
Beads and. But it was we still try on Sundays to get together as a family, and of course, your family grows because the children grow up and they get married and have children, and the children have boyfriends and girlfriends, and you know,
along,
it's
right?
it's wonderful to have these big things, and it's. Hard to get a Sunday when we're all together, but we do the best we can.
Yeah, tell me about some of the recipes. Obviously, these are ones you know that you can always tell the page in a cookbook where
oh,
you've actually used it because
yeah.
it has little spots and you've written something on it.
There are many of them. I got a kick out of one of your postings the other day about, and I can't remember what it was. Not truly vicious,
malicious and
malicious.
Delicious.
Yeah,
invasive species.
But I looked through all of the things, no, truly disturbing recipes.
The good housekeeping.
Yes.
It was like a...
Most of those I've made.
Oh, my gosh.
Truly.
Oh, now have you made the bananas wrapped in ham?
No, that I didn't. But, you know, again, it's a color thing. It looked ugly. But
okay.
if you did something with the color of it, it probably would be good. We put salt on our... brownies now, you
right,
know,
right.
That's
salt and sweet.
And, you know, we wrap prosciutto around the melon.
Sure.
I know, so I guess it's not that much of a leap to wrap it around a banana, maybe.
No.
Well, maybe it is.
and then to
cover it with hollandaise, you know, there's that.
Oh, you could put hollandaise on anything and it's good.
Well,
I could eat hollandaise just with a spoon. I could also be as big as a Sherman tank if But, you know, why gild a lily? But there, the liverwurst pate with cream cheese on it, that was a staple on
Was
Christmas
it really?
Buffets.
So,
oh,
so,
yes.
So it was like iced, only you cut into mm-hmm, it, and it's mm-hmm. and it's like liverwurst or Braunschweig
right.
or something?
And again, 70 years old, I've forgotten what some of them were, but my sister and I got such a kick out of looking through that. They, oh, we ate this. Oh, this was so-and-so's popular recipe when we got together. And well, in fact... We used to have parties, a lot of parties in between
and
Thanksgiving
did you entertain?
And Christmas. Oh, yes. Did a lot of
Oh, no, this is a used cookbook. This one is a good one, you can tell.
When I first got, I have the original food processor, the original Cuisinart.
Do you really? An original Cuisinart?
Which broken it so badly, it's almost not usable. Well, I called the company, and I said, is it possible to have a trade-in? Because this is a little bitty bowl. The plastic is all breaking on the bowls. I can't get any replacement parts for it. And they said, well, no, they wouldn't give me a trade-in, but they'd love to have it for their museum.
Oh, my goodness, you have a museum piece.
I have a museum piece. But without, I mean, the Cuisinart is something that's one of the tools I simply could not live without.
Now, that seems to be a very 70s thing.
Oh, I guess. My KitchenAid standard mixer and the Cuisinart were the two. They may have been wedding presents, late 60s.
That sounds about right.
I still start using it. There it is.
Oh, my.
And it's called a snow-capped pâté. But anyway, that's something we'd have every single.
And it does look like it could fool you into thinking perhaps it was a cake, you know?
Oh, sure. Oh, sure. Well, there was another recipe, a watermelon cake, that you made with, let's see. You made it in a big Pyrex plastic, and it was a Pyrex recipe from the Pyrex company. How did they do that? It was a green Jello, and then something, and then it ended up ice cream on the inside. Oh, it was curious. I'll have to look for that because that really is an odd one.
So Nessie, you've got notes on your chicken liver pate recipe, right?
Well, because chicken livers are not the same as Braunschweiger.
I mean, right.
You know, it's a little different. My family like the chicken liver best, but uh-huh. I have found most people, if they think, well, especially the friends of the children. They had no sophistication at all. But all of these wonderful casserole-y things, right. Which were just such...
Even the colors in the pictures look kind of 70s, you know?
Yeah, well, now there's one of those kind of odd-looking little wrapped-up things with sauce over it. Chicken and
Nessie, you're making quenelles there in the picture, you know? So that's a very...
I never made those.
Very popular thing these days.
What was it? Something de neige. Boule de neige. Snow. And it was a custard that had little meringue-y things floating in
something
it.
In the snow, right?
For a Christmas buffet. We made it. Lots of things with saucies. Oh, I used to love things like Coquille Saint-Jacques, and I still have all the little seashells that...
Oh, really? Oh, my goodness. In. You did that because those are the things that, those retro recipes, it seems like things that I would like to try, and I, you know, because I've never made
delicious.
Them.
Delicious. And it's really easy to do, but again, highly caloric. I mean, hugely caloric. And people my age are worried about their cholesterol. I don't know about you. Of course, if you die with a smile on your face, there's nothing wrong with that.
It's the Coquille Saint-Jacques that did me in.
Yeah. There are worse things in this life. But anyway, and quiche, of course.
Oh,
quiche
again,
was
70s.
Just 70s. Oh, my. People say, well, how do you learn to do this? Well, you just start doing it. And when you're learning, you don't know how to do it. You just follow. If you can read and follow directions... I say that about gardening, too. If you know the recipe, you can grow anything.
Well, that's true. So you just follow the
directions. But just get over the fear of I can't do it, and just try it. And if your Jell-O mold slides off the plate, well, too bad. Eat it off the kitchen counter with a spoon. Got to have a sense of humor.
Exactly. Oh, my goodness.
Got to have a sense of humor.
Now, you have a Joy of Cooking cookbook, too. But now
this is
a classic. 19,
now, this I don't write in. But
now was this your mother's, or did you get it?
It was my aunt's, who just passed away at 101 week and one day.
Oh my gosh!
Isn't that just phenomenal? And she was happy as a clam until the day she decided to go away.
We've been talking with Lynn Steinauer-Habig about vintage recipes, including a classic Jell-O salad. For more on the classic recipes that we've been talking about today, you can look for me, Jolene Ketzenberger, on Facebook and Instagram, and check out the photos. Eat, Drink, Indiana Radio is made possible with support from Eskenazi Health, providing care to nearly 1 million outpatient visitors each year with the mission to advocate, care, teach, and serve at its hospital and inpatient facility and 11 community health centers located throughout Indianapolis. EskenaziHealth.edu. Well, like I mentioned earlier in today's show, you can go to my Facebook page and check out photos of some of the vintage recipes we've been talking about. In fact, it was a comment on Facebook that led me to getting to sample another Jell-O recipe. Sarah Merle, food editor at Nouveau News Weekly, happened to mention a salad that she noticed at a family get-together, a salad made of lime jello. So I challenged Sarah to make that dish, and we would give it a try and report back. So here is how it turned out, with an honest reaction from Sarah's colleague, Nouveau reader behaviorist Brian Weiss.
Oh, so, for better or worse, this is lime jello. It has mandarin oranges, shredded fresh carrots, a whipped topping of kind of whipped up Philadelphia cream cheese and Cool Whip with a sprinkling of cheddar cheese over the top. I love my family, but I think this is proof that they do not love me in return.
And this is something that you've had at a family get-together, right?
Yeah. Yes. So I saw this the first time at a church wedding shower in Zanesville, Indiana, which is just south of Fort Wayne. I was told that this shows up frequently at family occasions, and I have seen it at several tables since then. I've only eaten it once the original time, and now this
one. And now you've made it yourself, so let's see.
Okay. Oh, my God.
All right. First thoughts?
Okay. So it's a really weird, reminds me of a Chicago mixed popcorn, where it's like the cheddar with the caramel.
That's funny, because it doesn't have anything to do with cheddar. Yes, you do have cheddar on top. Mm-hmm. But there's no caramel, there's no popcorn, so explain that comparison.
So there's a tanginess from the cheese. There's a certain, you know, the classic sort of cream cheese, a little bit of that tanginess. It's totally muted by all of the whipped topping. And then when you actually, I'm kind of upset right now, because it's not terrible. It's not as terrible as the first time I remember it. Or maybe my tastes have gotten, I'm going to take another bite. Like, conceivably, you know, you live in the country, you haven't seen a fresh veggie, it's March, or fruit in a long time. It took me about 15 minutes to assemble, total. So it's fast. It's honestly not the worst thing I've ever tasted.
Okay, well, now that's not exactly a ringing endorsement, but it's not as bad as it might sound with the lime jello and the carrots and the whipped topping.
Oh. Ooh, I just got a bite of carrot. That's kind of interesting. You know what? Fine, Northern Indiana. Fine. Okay, I'll take it. I wouldn't eat this again. I wouldn't be upset if I showed up to a, you know, prison camp and this is what they were serving. I know it would be like a nicer prison camp, you know.
Now, these kind of things show up on family get-togethers, pitch-in, church suppers, that sort of thing. So when you, in your growing up, did you have salad that was jello? You know, the jello salad concept? Because it wasn't anything that I ever had growing up.
No, I didn't have it except for when I was in Northern Indiana with my family, with my extended family. My mom did all, we never had anything that sat in the fridge for more than, you know, 20, she didn't cook things like that. So, this is really alien to me, but it does, like, I feel like I should be uncomfortable and censoring myself at a family reunion right now. Like, there's a lot of emotional baggage going
on. Like Aunt so-and-so is saying, so, Sarah, how do you like the salad?
Oh, yeah. No, totally. Like I'm 30 seconds from being grilled about my relationship status and plans for marriage and childbearing. Like, I feel the anxiety coming on just from the textures of my mouth.
Okay, so a reaction to the jello salad.
Brian Weiss, reader behaviorist.
Good, bad, something that you would actually seek out. What do you think?
Definitely jelly. A little crunchy jelly. I've never had that before. Definitely a new for me. I can taste like carrot strands, which is a little weird. And then at the end, it's whatever that creamy something. Okay, here's how the process went. It went green jello first. It's the slimy green jello first. Then it went crunchy carrots next. And then whatever the after thing was, the little white stuff on the top, finished it off with a little punch in the face. So that's how I would describe that right there.
All right, now I have to have a bite.
I mean,
all right. Orange.
You got to get the full texture and flavor experience.
All right. Okay, so let's see. Mm-hmm. Texture and flavor experience. That's about right. Okay.
You're right. So it's not horrible.
No, it's understandable.
You can yes, right, right. So it's not like you're gonna like make a face and spit it out because of course you've got the sweet Jell-O, the lime Jell-O, mm-hmm. and the carrots are kind of sweet. You know, so you got carrots in there, and the you know mandarin oranges are completely inoffensive and you know sweet little things too, but that's just kind of an odd combination, don't you think?
Yeah, I mean, I see it in the same way that like that I get like. Farm people just eat differently. They work harder. They're just different. Maybe this is like the farm version of refreshing. Like this is the farm early spring version of a cucumber salad. I don't know.
Right, because it's green and okay, so it's green. Okay, so it's got that going for it. Yeah. So you can imagine that someone was gonna. You know, because you've got carrots year-round, you know, sure. And so they've shredded some carrots in there and opened a can of mandarin oranges, I'm sure, which is probably just what you did here, and opened a container of shredded cheese and a container of Cool Whip and a container of cream cheese.
Yeah, I got really nervous because I had just done a lot of cooking last night if I would have enough dishes to do it, except that it took exactly one mason jar and everything else I just kind of tore open and poured into a pan. And I was like, oh, well, this makes sense on this... You know, as far as convenience cooking goes, it makes sense.
Right. Well, not a lot of cooking involved. So more like, you know, yeah. More of assembly.
Yeah, I was going to say assembly and a little bit of gelatin alchemy. You know, you got to get the hot water, but like the most thing you have to do is boil 2 cups of hot water. So, yeah. Oh, it was rough.
So it's not anything you'd make again. I mean, unless someone said, oh, Sarah, bring that Jell-O salad to the kitchen.
2 reasons I'd ever make this again. If someone requested it and if I was trying to get someone to break up with me without actually having to do anything. Just start serving them this with every meal and pretend like I got it stuck in my brain that it was their favorite. And they'd be like, I have to get out of this relationship.
We've been talking with Sarah Merle of Nouveau News Weekly in Indianapolis. You can find her on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram and follow her food writing at nouveau.net. Well, as you may have noticed by now, Facebook posts about what I'm up to or cooking or thinking about tend to yield a lot of comments. And some of those comments turn into stories like the whole vintage Jell-O salad recipe idea. So it's not really a surprise that another reader volunteered to make a classic dish this week as well. Courtney Yarborough, Assistant Director of Development at the School of Public and Environmental Affairs here in Indianapolis, also made a classic gelatin dish right out of a 1967 edition of The Joy of Cooking. Tell me about the molded avocado salad.
Sure. So I was looking through this cookbook, The Joy of Cooking, circa 1967, I think. In trying to decide which would be the most palatable to my friends. And this one looked like basically guacamole, kind of, with a few changes. So that's the one I went with because it was easy and looked kind of good.
So tell us what all's in that recipe.
Yeah. So it's regular gelatin, lemon juice, avocado, celery salt, Worcestershire, cayenne and pimento, and I added green onions and extra cayenne because I like it spicy.
Now, so how did it come out?
Actually, not too terrible. I had a few picky eaters that tried it, and they liked it, and it really was more like just a light avocado guacamole kind of version, except with Worcestershire, which I've never used in guacamole before. So,
now how did the whole gelatin part of it go? Because it says it has a tablespoon of gelatin, right?
Yeah. So, it actually wasn't as hard as I thought it was going to be to do. Blooming the gelatin was the most annoying part because it got gooey, of course.
So you used a little packet of unflavored gelatin for this one, right?
Correct. And so one packet is 1 tablespoon, so I just used 2 packets for this, for this recipe.
So how did that change your guacamole?
Well, first it was super firm, which was not too bad, actually. And it never browned, so that was really helpful. So I think it was almost, for a summer party, it would be almost a better version, so you didn't have to worry about the oxidation situation.
Oh my gosh, Nessie, I never thought about that. But so maybe it all helps, you know?
Yeah. I mean, it was pretty good, actually. So
now,
How did it work with, did you mold it or did you just do it in the bowl?
So I don't have a Jell-O mold except for a brain that I use at Halloween.
Well, maybe not the appropriate thing for guacamole.
Yeah, it didn't look quite right. So I just used an 8x8 dish and lined it with saran wrap and flipped it out.
Oh, so it came out shaped like the bowl then?
Yeah, yeah.
And it came out all right. So yeah, you know, I wonder, you know, what you imagine, you know, trying to unmold things, you know, and having it all like slide off the plate, like in Julie and Julia movie. But it worked.
Yeah, it worked, and it actually wasn't as slippery as I thought it might be. So I ended up I was on my way out to a FIFA World Cup soccer watch party, and so I just threw it on a paper plate and took it, and it was stayed in the right shape the whole time, and yeah, it was great.
And people enjoyed it?
People, they did. One person was skeptical, but the others really liked it. So I might have to do it again, actually.
Would you really? You would really try it again?
I think I would. I might change a few of the, I might use a jalapeno instead of cayenne or something like that. But yeah, I think I'd probably try it again.
Oh my goodness. Now tell me a little bit about your cookbook. It looks like a well-used cookbook.
Yeah, actually a coworker gave it to me after her mother was done using it and in exchange for just making her something out of it. So I still have to do that. But I go back to it when I'm looking for a classic of a classic of a classic. So
yeah, people tend to look back at vintage stuff and think that they're just silly or goofy or whatever. What did you think?
So I noticed that in a lot of them, the serving sizes weren't quite listed, or I had some questions that weren't quite answered, which are in the modern cookbooks, everything's laid out for you very clearly. But luckily I had enough know-how to sort of work it out on my own. But it could be hard if you're not used to that. But other than that, I think it's great ideas for bringing back old favorites.
You know, do you have any other favorites, you know, from any old classic recipes that you do and that you actually do make?
Yeah, so I used it for biscuits before, which I really liked. But now, after looking through all of these Jell-O salads, there's a beet one that's on my list and a tomato aspic one with creamy centers, which is like cream cheese and stuff that I can't not make.
Oh, my gosh. Now, does this use little balls of cream cheese in there?
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. So someone was actually telling me about something that had the little balls of cream cheese in it. I think you probably have found it.
Yeah. That looks, I think it's right there.
Oh, so there's the beet. Oh my goodness. These are great. Tomato aspic and then with tasty centers. Oh, that's interesting.
Definitely on my list to try. Maybe for a holiday when I have a lot of people to try it.
We've been talking with Courtney Yarborough, Assistant Director of Development at the School of Public Environmental Affairs here in Indianapolis, about the vintage recipe for a molded avocado salad that she made recently. To join in on all the food-related conversations that often lead to stories like these, look for me on Facebook. Well, anyone who knows me or who has followed my food writing knows that I am a fan of the breaded pork tenderloin sandwich. It's one of my favorites, and honestly, if it's done right, I think it's a terrific sandwich. Flavorful meat, crisp breading, some personality with the whole bigger-than-the-bun thing, and it has a true Indiana heritage. You can clearly see its German roots as a distant cousin to schnitzel. And I've found a kindred spirit in local musician Rick Garrett, who for the past 4 years has written a blog reviewing Indiana's tenderloins, breadedtenderloin.wordpress.com. So I was happy to head out this week to a local restaurant to have lunch with Rick and talk tenderloins. So like I was saying, you are the tenderloin connoisseur. So Rick, tell me how you got started talking tenderloins.
Well, I've always loved tenderloins, and my wife and I were at a little pub in Indianapolis, 106 in College, called Jimmy B's. We'd never been there before, and I got the tenderloin and tried it. And I remember I bit into it, and I said to my wife, "Oh, my gosh, this is the best tenderloin I've ever had in my life. It's incredible." And so we talked a little bit, and she said, "You should start reviewing these." And I got to thinking there are a ton of food review sites out there, but fewer specialized. I thought, tenderloin's part of our culture.
It absolutely is, and so it really is a part of Indiana, isn't it?
It is. It is. You find some in Iowa and just a little bit, but in Indiana, it is part of our culture.
So when was that? When did you get the idea to do this?
Well, that was about 4 years ago, so I just scribbled some notes while I was sitting there eating that tenderloin and went to WordPress and formed a blog and posted it And suddenly I started getting emails.
And, I love that.
And a part of it was because it was kind of an unknown place, wasn't a chain restaurant, so I tend to go towards locally owned places, and I like to go to kind of out-of-the-way places where people don't go. Do hit a chain restaurant occasionally. So it just kind of blossomed from there.
Now tell me how many you've done over the past 4 years.
I've done about 150 over the past 4 years.
That's a lot of tenderloins.
I've eaten more than that. Some I haven't reviewed because they are a return visit. Some weren't worth reviewing.
Well, you know, that happens.
It does happen. It does happen. But I always try to give a fair review, and kind of had to learn the difference between a tenderloin and a fritter, because when I was growing up, we had pork fritters as a staple of our diet, but there's a big difference between it.
Oh, exactly. So I think people know, you know, like the frozen pork fritter. That's kind of a college staple, you know, if you don't, you know, a kind of inexpensive item. You see them right. In the freezer sections.
Right. Pete's Pride is the big one that made them up at Muncie when I lived up there.
Exactly.
I refer to those as kind of cardboard with a crust. They'll fill you up, but that's about it.
But unfortunately, sometimes that is what you get when you think you're going to get a tenderloin.
It is. And I've got to the point where I will always ask, do you have a real tenderloin or do you have a fritter? There are a couple of companies now that are doing real tenderloins, but they flash fry them. So a restaurant might order them pre-made, but they're a real tenderloin. And folks have got pretty good about telling me the truth, although I've had a couple try to pass a fritter off as a tenderloin.
So tell me what you look for when you're analyzing a tenderloin, when you see one come out from on a plate. What do you think?
Well, the first thing I look for is it in a puddle of grease, because it's hard to deep fry something without it being greasy. I've been told the secret is to kind of flash fry it, do it very quickly so the grease doesn't soak into the breading. The second thing I look for is it panned out like a hubcap and, you know.
Oh, one of the huge ones, bigger than your head kind of thing.
Because I found with those, what I like about a tenderloin is that if it's thick enough, you get the distinct texture of the breading and the distinct texture of the meat. For me, a lot of food is about texture. But with those really thinly panned out ones, they all just kind of mush together and you don't get a good flavor. You just get one crunch and a bite.
That's true. I also don't like the really thin, crispy ones that are sort of cracker-like, you know, and that's all you get is the crunch. I agree with you. I like to have the different textures, and I like to, you know, actually, you know, be able to see the meat and the breading. Now talk to me a little bit about the breading, because I'm kind of picky about breading.
I am a little picky about breading, and I've had some that have had some really interesting breadings. I like the pretty traditional cornmeal-type breading. There's a restaurant up in Pendleton, Indiana, called The Old Trail that breads theirs with potato chips, which is pretty good for about the first half of the sandwich, but then it starts getting soggy. I've had a couple of them, and it's hard to hold the crispness for that breading, you know, through the life of the sandwich. I like to talk while I eat, so it takes a while.
I know. So you're looking for a crisp breading, but now tell me if you notice if the breading stays on. That's one of my things.
I do. I like the breading to stay on. It needs to stay on the meat. So that's not. And the other thing I look for is the shape, because you can just about always tell a pre-made one, a mass-produced one, because they're all uniform in shape. So if it comes out kind of misshapen, that's a huge plus in their favor.
Okay, so that's something to look for, is that it's not a standardized shape. All right. Now we have to talk bun, right? You know, because sometimes you get the tiny little bun, you know, so that you know the sandwich is so much bigger than that is. Does the bun make any difference to you?
Not a whole lot. I like a traditional hamburger bun or the egg buns. I like those awfully well. I think it's easy. You look at a tenderloin and you think it's just a piece of fried meat, but they actually have a pretty delicate flavor to me. And if you get into fancy things like a pretzel bun or there's another one I can't think of off the top of my head, I think it's easy to overwhelm the flavor of the meat itself. So I look for something that's a compliment but doesn't overwhelm it, just like the breading. A lot of people will put, you know, garlic or, you know,
lots of big seasonings in the bread.
Exactly. So that kind of overwhelms the flavor of the meat.
Now, toppings. What, you have favorites?
Mayonnaise, ketchup, and onion. That's my go-to thing there. I think, again, that complements the sandwich without overwhelming it. One of the things I found in doing this is there's a lot of people that actually prefer the fritter to a tenderloin.
Oh no, really? Because you know that's just a deal breaker for me when you get the sad little frozen fritter.
It is. It is up in Muncie. There's a restaurant called Richard's. You may remember Richard's restaurants from up there. They have both a hand-breaded tenderloin and a fritter on their menu.
And they said, so you specify which one?
You do, and they say it's about, and here's the tenderloins.
Oh, thank you. This is great.
We've been talking with Rick Garrett, a local blogger who focuses on Indiana's breaded pork tenderloin sandwiches. We'll be back with more from Rick here on WFYI and WFYI.org. Eat, Drink, Indiana Radio is made possible with support from Eskenazi Health. With its 315-bed hospital and inpatient facilities and 11 community health centers located throughout Indianapolis. EskenaziHealth.edu. So, what makes a really good breaded pork tenderloin sandwich? And where can you get one? Local musician and blogger Rick Garrett, who reviews tenderloins at breadedtenderloin.wordpress.com, has figured it all out, and he explains it all as we enjoy tenderloin sandwiches at Binkley's in Indianapolis, and he offers a few more tenderloin recommendations as well. So what we are doing today is we are actually trying a breaded pork tenderloin at a local restaurant, Binkley's, at the corner of College and Kessler in Indianapolis. So I think this is pretty terrific. Now I get to actually get your reactions to a tenderloin.
Yes.
So first off, what do you think?
Well, first off, they're both similar but not the same. So this looks like they're hand-breaded and hand-cut. I see the grill marks on them, which is a good, at least on mine. I don't see them on yours. Maybe a little bit. You look like you have a lot more breading on yours than I do on mine. I prefer a little thinner breading, so this works. I see some flakes of pepper in there. So
there's a seasoned breading, because sometimes the breading just is flavorless, right? But yeah.
The thing I do is cut a little corner off. Live on the radio, they can't see what I'm doing. I'm taking my knife and fork and cutting a corner off the tenderloin.
Now what are you looking for?
Looking for the color of the meat. It should be nice and white. It's obviously just out of the fryer. Breading's staying on, so I'll try a bite. Maybe you'll hear the crunch. Oh, that's good.
Yeah, is it?
That's really good. The breading has just enough seasoning to give it flavor but not overwhelm the meat. The meat on this one is exceptional. Tastes like a pork chop almost.
Okay, now that's good, because sometimes there's not a lot of flavor to the meat. You know, you've had a lot of those tenderloins too, I'm sure.
I have, and you can see the breading is pretty thin on mine, which is a good thing. Really, really good.
So if you could maybe tell me a few of your favorite tenderloins in and around Indianapolis?
Oh, absolutely, sure. Jimmy B's, which I mentioned earlier, is at 106th and College. Great place, little dive bar. As good as the tenderloin is, the people watching is just as good. It's a great, kind of a blue-collar working man's bar. It's a great place. It is, because it's Hamilton County, it's smoker-friendly, so if you have an aversion to smoke, you might want to go at an off hour.
Oh, now that is interesting, because in Indianapolis, of course, you know, there's the smoking ban.
Exactly. There's a place on 96th and Mud Creek Road called CR Heroes that is fabulous tenderloin. They call theirs the Hoosier Daddy, which is a large version, and I believe they have the Hoosier Mama, which is kind of a small pared down version.
Well, that's kind of fun to have a different size, because some of them do get pretty big.
They do. And I love that place. It's locally owned, just like Jimmy B's. So I kind of expected a superhero theme, CR Heroes, and I walked in and saw a couple of Batman and Superman things. But the bulk of it is dedicated to local firefighters and police, which I thought was a
Sure, really nice.
It was a really, really nice place. I've always been fond of the Gaslight Inn down there at 2280 South Meridian.
Right, now that, right? It's, you know, that's a historic building, supposed to be haunted, that sort of thing?
It is. I've never had any weird experiences. I've seen some weird people in there, but I've never had any weird experiences. Muldoon's up in Carmel has a very good tenderloin.
You know, that's one that people have recommended to me, and I did try that one not too long ago. A nice, straightforward tenderloin.
It is. We're here at Binkley's in Broad Ripple today. very good tenderloin. I would highly recommend that. The Aristocrat just down the street from us has a great history in Indianapolis.
So now we've talked a little bit about some of the things you look for. Are there some places that stand out to you for particular reasons, you know, on their tenderloins? Well, you mentioned, you know, the local ownership, you know, it is kind of a big thing.
It is a big thing. I always look for locally owned restaurants. John's Famous Stew, which is down on Kentucky Avenue, has a really good tenderloin, but they have one like I've never seen, and that is a tenderloin topped with stew.
Doesn't, oh, my goodness, right?
But it's topped with stew. I'm not...
Is it still like a breaded tenderloin?
It is a breaded tenderloin just served on a dinner plate with a big heaping scoop of stew on top of it. Personally, I'm not crazy about it, but a lot of people really rave about it. Gray's Cafeteria in Mooresville has a tenderloin and gravy, so it's got a milk gravy on top of it.
Okay, now that's kind of harkening back to what I think are the tenderloin's its heritage, you know, as a schnitzel, right?
Exactly. You know, that's where the tenderloin came from, is the accepted theory that the Germans were looking for a way to recreate the schnitzel sandwiches that they had and created the tenderloin. So,
well, it's, you know, it sounds plausible to me. I've not really seen it proven, it may be, but to me that seems like a certainly a logical reason as to, you know, how the tenderloin developed such a following in Indiana and in Indianapolis, you know, very strong German heritage.
Exactly. Matter of fact, for my 100th review, I made the trip up to Huntington, Indiana, to Nick's Kitchen, which is the place that's supposed to have sold the first breaded tenderloin.
So that's like the tenderloin mecca, and actually, that's one I haven't been to yet.
It's pretty darn good. It's not the best I've ever had, but it certainly was above average. And the place is just a piece of living history, a lot of local history. And I got to say, that's the best darn sugar cream pie I've ever had in my life up there. It was incredible.
Well, now they do advertise the sugar cream pies too. There's the sign in the window about the pies too.
Growing up in a small town, I have a real affinity for small town restaurants, so that's a good one. If somebody wants to make a drive, there's one I just had this weekend. I spend a lot of time in Metamora, Indiana, and there's a restaurant down there. I had not tried the tenderloin, but they have their pork grown locally. Metamora has a working grist mill right on the canal, and they use the cornmeal from that grist mill for their breading.
Oh, now that's great. Now talk about local.
Yeah. So everything's within, you know, like an eighth of a mile of the restaurant. And it was really good. They don't deep fry theirs. They do it.
Bake it?
Cast iron skillet.
Oh, it's pan fried.
It is pan fried, which gives a whole different texture. It's kind of interesting because most tenderloins are pretty much, if you talk about crunchiness and texture, they're pretty uniform all the way through the sandwich. But the ones that are pan fried tend to be crunchier around the edges and a little softer in the middle. But it worked really, really well.
Other places worth a drive to try to hit?
Fort Wayne has some really good ones up there. So there is a place in Indianapolis, the Castleton Grill, which is owned
Don Hall's, right?
So he has several restaurants up in the Fort Wayne area, so that's a good one. There's some really good ones in Muncie. There's a town north of Muncie, about 15 miles, called Albany, Indiana. It's a place called Pete's Duck Inn that has a fabulous tenderloin, really good.
What makes that one so good?
Oh, it's not pounded out. It's so the sandwich does not really extend over the edge of the bun very much. So when I first got it, I thought, oh, this isn't much of a sandwich, but it's nice and thick and incredibly tasty, and the pork is grown on a local farm up there in Albany, so everything is extremely fresh. Interesting throwback restaurant. They have frog legs, and one of the only places I know that serves Rocky Mountain oysters.
Oh, my goodness. Well, now that's a throwback.
That is a throwback. So that's up in Albany, Indiana.
Tell me where your readers are.
Well, the bulk are in the Midwest or transplanted Midwesterners. I get a lot from the United States. Indiana is number one. Florida is number two, I think because of all the retired folks from Indiana that live down there. Get a lot from Iowa, which is another big tenderloin state. It's kind of interesting because you jump across Illinois and don't find any tenderloins, and then they're really popular again in Iowa. And they're significantly different. All of the ones in Iowa, even the ones that are hand-breaded and hand-cut, are pounded paper thin.
Oh, really? Now, see, I've wondered about the Iowa tenderloins. So they're not our big, thick, you know?
They're not. So I found them in Iowa. The farthest west I have found is St. Charles, Missouri, which is just on the other side of St. Louis. And it was a darn fine tenderloin, except it was cut long and narrow and served on a hoagie bun.
Oh, well, now that's just wrong.
It's just wrong. But it was a good tenderloin. Occasionally I'll find them down around Cincinnati, right where Indiana, Ohio, and Kentucky come together. But they're really pretty much a regional food.
I just find them interesting, you know, because I think it's a great representation of Indiana, you know, with pork, you know, and a German heritage, and like you said, it's a good sandwich. I mean, you have the meat, you have the crunch, so you have the different textures.
That's right. Locally raised, it's health food.
No, you can't possibly do tenderloins all the time. So what do you do in your real life?
In my real life, well, I am a musician and a comedian. After having done a lot of things during my life, been in the ministry, firefighter, paramedic, lots of different things. Officially retired from all that. So I play music with my wife Holly, and I do stand-up comedy. And we have a music and arts co-op in Metamora, Indiana, where we teach music and have art workshops and have a retail music store and so on. So most of my life revolves around the arts in one way or the other.
Now, where can people follow your blog or find out some more information?
Sure. The blog is breadedtenderloin.wordpress.com. I actually wanted to make it breadedtenderloin.com, but somebody owns that domain and wanted like $10,000 for me to buy it.
Oh, for heaven's sakes.
So it wasn't that important. And my personal website is Rick Garrett, G-A-R-R-E-T-T, rickgarrett.net.
Well, thank you very much.
Thank you, Jolene. It's been such a treat to meet you today, and I hope our paths cross again soon.
Absolutely, over another tenderloin.
Yes, absolutely.
We've been talking tenderloins with local blogger Rick Garrett. And if you have some tenderloin recommendations of your own, please drop us an email here at eatdrinkindy@gmail.com. You've been listening to Eat Drink Indiana Radio on WFYI HD to the Point. I'm your host, Jolene Kenzenberger. Happy 4th of July from all of us here at Eat Drink Indiana Radio, and thank you so much for tuning in. And thanks also to our guests this week, cooking enthusiast Lynn Steinhauer-Habig, Nouveau News Weekly food editor Sarah Murrell, Courtney Yarborough, assistant director of development at the School of Public and Environmental Affairs at IUPUI, and tenderloin connoisseur Rick Garrett. And thanks to producer John Kenzenberger for helping to bring you Eat Drink Indiana Radio.